Hi, my name is Mark Blythe. If I have a gift, it's simplification. I'm able to take big economic ideas and break them down so that everyone can see what's really being said behind all the fancy math and complex words. I sometimes do this solo, and sometimes I do it with a co-author. In this case, for my most recent book, Inflation, A Guide for Users and Losers, it was inspired by and co-authored with my friend and colleague, Niccolo Fracaroli. As inflation began to rise in 2022, we decided to write a guide to inflation for everyone. Or as we put it, for inflation's users and losers. Because yes, there are some of both. Here are five key insights from the book. Our first insight is that people can get quite confused about what inflation actually is. Because what economists think inflation is and what normal people think it is turn out to be quite different things. Inflation is a rise in the general level of all prices. It's not when houses get more expensive or the price of gasoline goes up. It's a general rise in the level of all prices. Now that seems pretty straightforward, so why the confusion? One way to see why this is confusing is to think about the economy, wait for it, as a glass of water. I know, stay with me. Picking up the glass of water, economists look at the thin line at the top of the glass, the surface tension, and examine how it's changed over time. That is, they focus on the rate of change in prices, the inflation rate. The public instead looks at the amount of water in the glass and notes that it's gone up and it's not coming down. They look at the level of prices. This creates a world where economists can say inflation has decreased by X percent, while normal people can say, are you kidding me? Eggs are still twice what they used to be. And both can be correct. One group looks at the rate of change and the other one looks at its level. A similar confusion comes from the fact that inflation is measured by a price index. That's how central banks keep track of thousands of purchased items, 80,000 in the case of the Federal Reserve, noting if they increased or decreased and averaging all those changes into a single number. The inflation rate. Now, to make this number more comparable across time, these folks remove items that jump around a lot, like food and fuel. The problem is, of course, that normal folks, especially those who find themselves in the bottom 60% of the income distribution, the majority of Americans, spend a really big chunk of their incomes on food and fuel. So removing them from the index creates a disconnect between what people personally perceive as inflation and what the official figures say. This is why, depending on where you are in the income distribution, your subjective experience of inflation may be more accurate than the official figures. So, don't let them tell you it's not. Our second insight is that when you hear someone saying, we all suffer from inflation, don't believe them. That would be true if we all had the same income, but we don't. Because as we just said, how inflation impacts you depends upon how much income you have. If you shop at Dollar General and prices go up 10%, you will really feel that and have to make hard choices about your family budget. In contrast, if you shop at Whole Foods, you literally don't care about inflation if you're willing to overpay that much for groceries to begin with. Again, what matters here is how much of your income goes on consumption. If you're in the bottom half of the income distribution, then a large chunk of your income goes on consumption items such as food, fuel, and rent. Inflation, when prices go up, acts as a tax on consumption. So the more you consume relative to your income, the more it hurts. You are, as we say in the book, an inflation loser. But if you're in the top 10% of the income distribution or above, even if you shop at Whole Foods, you proportionately spend much less of your overall income on consumption. And you probably have a mortgage rather than pay rent, which is building an asset rather than consuming. Congratulations, you're an inflation winner. And just as different individuals win or lose according to their income level, so do firms according to how inflation affects their products. Firms in markets with very few competitors absolutely do try to take advantage of the confusion that exists over what prices should be when there is an inflation. They try to raise prices beyond what they would normally get away with. Economists assume that such price gouging can't happen because competition between firms in competitive markets would mean that if a firm raised their prices, another one would cut theirs in response and take the price hiker's market share. But in many markets, from eggs to cereals to oil to gas, there's just one or two suppliers, and so such competition is absent. So much so, in fact, that according to the European Central Bank, some 40% of the inflation in the EU in 2022 was caused by firms jacking up prices. They win, you lose. This leads to our third insight, that the tools we have to fight inflation also create winners and losers. That ever-ready hammer for the nail of inflation? It's always to raise interest rates. So why is that? Central banks like to pretend that what they do, monetary policy as they call it, raising and lowering interest rates, is technical and neutral. They like to say that they don't pick winners and losers, because after all, everyone suffers from inflation. In contrast, what politicians do, fiscal policy, making decisions over who to tax and who to spend money on, that's political. They pick winners and losers. Seen this way, monetary policy is neither political nor distributional, and is therefore quite unlike taxes. It turns out this is not quite true either. When prices go up, central banks raise interest rates to cool the economy. And once again, your income level really matters for how this impacts you. If you're poor, then you probably already pay much more for your credit than a rich consumer. So raising rates from a higher baseline doubly impacts your consumption, and not in a good way. If you're rich, in contrast, you already pay less for your credit. You're credit worthy. And what's more, you probably own interest-bearing assets such as bonds and other investments that earn more from higher rates. In short, the very act of hiking rates rewards savers and punishes borrowers, which is the definition of picking winners and losers. Whether this is the price to be paid for killing inflation is a legitimate question. But the notion that we all pay the same price for doing so simply isn't true. And you know what else is true? Some firms and individuals really make out like bandits on inflation. There are inflation mega winners. By one estimate, US oil companies made $220 billion in excess profits in 2022. And if you happen to live in the top 1% of the US income distribution and are therefore amongst the folks who hold half the shares in the stock market, and hence you own these companies, you would have received half of that number back with those share prices going up and the dividends paid out to those companies. That is a $100 billion win. In contrast, while ordinary folks' nominal wages went up across the board in most countries because of inflation, their real wages, that is the wage that they get paid, the wage increase they get paid minus the inflation, never match the increase in prices. The vast majority of us are in fact inflation losers, but some firms do quite well, and some firms and some folks really win big. Our fourth insight is that the way we think about inflation shapes how we respond to it. Much of that thinking is drawn from the 1970s, from the last big outbreak of inflation. Policymakers and economists think of that past inflationary period as being caused by two main mistakes: the government printing too much money and workers demanding too high pay increases. The take-home lesson from that period was that inflation rose because people came to expect prices to keep rising. And so central banks had to develop a reputation for being willing to raise interest rates, even at the price of creating unemployment, to get those price expectations back down. This is a good story, but that may not be quite right either. First of all, we no longer live in the 70s. The economy today is completely different from back then in terms of what is made and what is consumed. Today, less than 10% of workers are in unions, and for many workers, real wages have been stagnant for decades. If prices are going to rise, it's not coming from there. Second, much of the reduction in inflation since the 1980s has been because of factors such as 500 million Chinese workers joining the global labour supply, and US corporations taking advantage of that to both lower prices and boost profits. Globalization, as it was called. That way of doing things may be on the way out, and with it, it's deflationary rather than inflationary impulse. Third, do people really have systematic inflation expectations that can be manipulated by central banks? As the confusions we talked about earlier showed, different people have quite different inflation expectations. Today, one of the biggest drivers of that difference is which party you support. If you're a Republican living in a Democratic presidency, you will probably expect higher inflation. And when the Republicans are in power, Democrats expect higher inflation too. Those expectations themselves may in part drive inflation. In such a world, the ability of central banks to control inflation with interest rates is probably a bit more limited than we like to think. Our fifth and final insight is that when you see the world as we do in this book, we are probably in for a more inflationary future. Not because of greedy unions or inflated expectations, but because most inflations are actually caused by what economists call supply shocks. Like COVID, when global supply chains shut down, causing all sorts of shortages that pushed up prices. Or like Ukraine, when Russia's invasion caused gas prices in Europe to go through the roof. When that happens, it's not clear that raising the price of borrowing money at the central bank is the best response. And there may be many more such supply shocks on the way. The Trump administration's belief in tariffs as a way to reindustrialize America is really just a supply shock by policy. If these tariffs are permanent, it means less imports, and those that remain will cost more, pushing up prices. And in a similar vein, although the Trump administration doesn't believe in climate change, its effects will continue to push up prices regardless of what anyone thinks about it. Whether it's in our food baskets due to crop stress from droughts, or food web degradation from heat stress, or the cost of insurance rising, as what we used to call once-in-a-100-year fires and floods become more like every other damn year events, these supply shocks will likely become more frequent and more intense over time. If so, we're going to all have to learn to live in a more inflationary world. And that's why we wrote the book. Because in such a world, it's more important than ever to figure out who wins, who uses, who loses, and even who abuses inflation. Thanks for listening.